is up, everybody? Welcome to the In the Crease podcast. I'm a very sleep-deprived Dan Abern, your co-host, and I'm joined by Kyle Devitt, whose heart, thankfully, did not give out during this weekend's NLL draft. How we doing, Kyle?
Yeah, I actually almost had a blood vessel pop in my eye, and I've had it happen before, but I dialed it down just in time to recover, write up my draft grades, which you can read on InsideTheCross.com right now, which... Like, I know, I'm going to be honest, I don't really remember writing a lot of them because I had like a stress-induced blackout. But when I went back to review them, I noticed that there was a plethora of the words coward and cowardice littered throughout. So I just deleted all those and posted it. But hey, we're here now. We're here to talk about college lacrosse.
Yeah, it was a long weekend, wasn't it? It started on Thursday.
Yes.
Duke Loyola. That game just did not live up to the hype. But, you know, that game's already been talked about. We're going to talk about some of the other games that, you know, I went to, you got to see on TV. I was down in Charlotte, North Carolina this past weekend for the Crown Classic featuring Jacksonville, Penn State, Cornell, and Towson. Penn State beating Cornell 19-13. A really fun game to be at, and thankful... The horrendous rain that plagued the Towson-Jacksonville game before, which was a total slip and slide, subsided for the majority of this one. So, Kyle, I think Penn State is back to being a wagon.
Oh, yeah. They're number one.
A wagon.
A wagon. But they're number one, too. So.
Yeah, yeah. But 43 goals over the weekend. The half-field offense is electric. And Grant Ament has gone from being a great player... to a truly elite player.
Hold on, Dan. What? Hold on. Can I get an amen?
Ba-dum-dum. Yes.
Nine assists from the pre-pod. You lied to me.
Nine assists against Cornell, and honestly, he makes it look extremely nonchalant, and that's because the offense is so crisp with the ball and the player movement. I think this game in particular. They stretched out Cornell's defense with O'Keefe, who just had a marvelous game with six goals. So many of their assisted goals came from passes that were 6 to 10 yards away. They really hurt them with that skip pass, that pass from distance. I just also think that the possession game was huge, and Penn State dominated at the X with Arcari, and he facilitated at least two transition goals, those behind-the-back goals from Grant Ament. Behind the back assists, excuse me, and just, you know, just keeping the ball out of Cornell's sticks was so important, because as we'll talk about in Cornell versus Towson, that can be a problem if Cornell finds the ball in their stick. But Penn State jumped out to a 9-2 lead, and that's when Cornell went with a goalie change, and things settled down a little bit, and they started converting on many of their possessions. But this result after that first quarter never felt in doubt. This was the game that really convinced me that Penn State is the best team in the country right now. They crush it on faceoffs. They have good players in the middle of the field. A lot of guys can contribute in that area too. And the depth of scoring right now is really impressive. You know, outside of Ament, they've got seven guys who can contribute, not just guys who can just show up on the field, guys who can actually score, guys who can dodge, guys who can facilitate. You know, the defense is good. They got a reliable goalie in Colby Canese. They 100% look the part.
I absolutely agree. And it's funny because I've seen them play in their loss, right? And I still came away impressed. And honestly, really one of the only reasons that Yale won that game is because of TD Ierland at the X. And if Penn State with Arcari, I think just Ierland has his number for whatever reason, or had it in that game. But if Arcari wins at a decent clip, even if it's 50-50, Penn State's pretty much beating everybody. They do so much with their possessions. They're not wasteful, right? We see a lot of these teams that have a ton of possessions. They play this up and down style. We'll get to it later, which in particular teams we're talking about, but they don't waste possessions. And if you don't waste possessions with the shot clock, you score. Or you get a good shot, or you extend it and you get two shot clocks. You know, you hits a pipe or bounces off the goalie, you pull it out and you do it again. I mean, they're very smart about how they play offense, which I think is something that also needs to be commended in addition to their prolific nature of scoring.
Yeah, and they want and they do put teams away early. The nine goals in a quarter is ridiculous. And the second game of their weekend was against Jacksonville, and you know, it was over about midway through the second quarter. Like, they had like 14 goals. They were averaging a goal, I did the math, every 80 seconds this game.
Shot clock, yeah. Every 80
seconds. Every 80 seconds. They get a goal clock, Penn State. Kyle, let's move on to Saturday. The rivalry, as some people would say. Syracuse 14, Johns Hopkins 10 in the Dome. Dome Gods showed out. They heard Rosie's pleas. They heard Rosie's praying.
They came out from the rafters and watched the fourth quarter, that's for sure. I feel like this was really touch and go for a lot of the game for both teams, but you know, Cuse closes one out. I don't know if it's the other thing. I'm watching this game and I'm like, I don't know if it's the camera or the atmosphere in the Dome, but I feel like Cuse and whoever they're playing score four absurd goals every week. Is that accurate? Am I crazy? It's just like absurd. There's an off the heezy goal in this game. Off the heezy.
There's some
right off the goalie's head.
The cameras and the multiple angles are really good there. But you're right. There does always seem to be like one goal where you're like, damn, that's cool.
Yeah, there's I think it's great angles. But you know, watching this one start to finish, you know, Hop scored in the first minute with the most basic lacrosse play in the world, the ISO sweep. And I just was like, oh no. I think I put it in the work Slack. I was like, oh no, this is going to be rough. But, you know, Cuse pulled it all together and the teams traded blows in some cases, quite literally. And I promised I'd talk about this, so I'm going to talk about it. The picks set by both teams in this game were actually disruptive. And I'm going to say this, they were also despicable. In like the most complimentary way possible. Like, I'll relate to this way. Dan, as a not tall person, I'm familiar with setting the blind pick. You know, I've been blown up doing it more times than I care to recall. But I can't say I've ever turned myself so that my hip smashes into the defender. That's not true. I've totally done that. But both defenses were getting mad at the picks on and off ball in a way that actually impacted the game. And the refs did a good job of recovering. But I think when I just want to talk about this real quick, because you don't hear people talk about this that often. When people talk about games being physical, they think that's just throwing checks and body checking. It's not. Being physical as a defender is, you know, stepping on people's feet, grabbing their jersey off ball, keeping your stick on the body, like doing little micro shoves on your man off the ball so his cut is a little bit off. Like, even if you throw a check, if the ball might look like it's coming to your guy, you can kind of get away with it, mm-hmm. right? But also when you're playing offense, you can do the same kind of stuff. You know, push off your defender, throw a light check on their stick right before you cut so they can't keep up with you, throw your hip into a pick, get purposely blown up by a pick to draw a call, personal favorite. that's all part of the game. But I feel like no one talks about it. And this game, it was like the highlight of every dark art you can participate in on defense and offense was right there. If you go back and watch this game and don't watch the ball, go back and watch this game and don't watch the ball at all. It'll be a lot of fun because you'll see every single thing that I just said happen on almost every play, you know, and it's the ref's job to adjudicate how that, you know, how that's disciplined, how the ball gets turned over by things like that. And I think once they started calling more things, it smoothed out, but this game had so many extracurriculars off ball. I was happy with that. And then they gave us great goals. So for me, pretty much game of the weekend, you know, it was a lot of fun.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think Cuse won this game for a lot of simple reasons. They settled in late in the game, started winning a bit more faceoffs. Drake Porter, I think, had like some really impressive clean saves. And then they just turned it into offense. And importantly, worked the clock when they needed to. We talked about last week against Virginia, they should have just ran out the clock, instead opted for a transition goal that did not work out for them, ended up costing them the game. Jacob Buttermore was a surprise stud, and just thought the way he kept his shots varied was really crucial. And I'd even go as far to say that this might be the most impressive shooting display we've seen from Syracuse just yet. What do you think, Kyle?
I think that's fair. I also think that, you know, Drake Porter had to adjust too in this game, and he did it in the second half. I think first half, you know, there were goals going in and he was just like shaking his head, picking the ball out. And then, he got some confidence. They made some stops and it really helped them, especially in the fourth quarter.
Now, where do we place these two teams after this result? Because I feel like Hopkins feels better than like a 2-3 team, but they are still a 2-3 team. And then Syracuse seems to have recovered very nicely from not only the Colgate loss in their opener, but last week's disappointment against Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, if you're asking me where I ranked them, I ranked Syracuse higher than Hopkins, and that has
really
nothing to do with my bias. I just think that there are strengths that Cuse has that Hop doesn't have, but Hop also has, you know, a lot of development that we've seen from the beginning of the season to now. So I'll give them credit. You know, Epstein is much better now than he was in the first couple games. You know, and that's down to coaching and adjusting, and they've done a good job of that. And likewise, you know, Syracuse is like that too, especially on the defensive end.
So there was a lot of neutral site games this weekend, one of them being out in California, the Pacific Coast Shootout. Actually, one of the better, well-attended games the whole season. I think another 6,000 people at least went to this one to see Notre Dame beat Denver 10-7. Sorry, I just couldn't get into this game. I don't know what it was. I thought Notre Dame's defense put the clamps down on their offense in a big way. Then the surging Irish offense came through with a big game. Costabile and Gleason are reliable guys, to say the least.
Yeah, I actually, I think Costabile missed the open net, and I just automatically tweeted, never bounce on an open net.
I remember that.
And one of his teammates was like tagged him. And I was like, no, don't do that. I hate when people, that's like, and the analogy I used was like, that's when like you tag a movie director in the review of their movie in which you criticize their movie. Like, it feels like really unfair to do that. Like, if they can choose to read your thing, but if you insert yourself into their timeline, it's like obstructive and like not constructive. And it can totally be taken out of context. But, you know, he was like, he didn't mean any harm. And frankly, I didn't mean any harm either. It's just like automatic to be like, no, don't ever do that. It's like this little bug in the back of my head that I can't say. But that was the highest level of engagement I had in this game. And I watched it start to finish. It was remarkable. It's like the most forgettable game I've ever watched.
Damn.
I just don't know what that's down to. I don't know if I was so preoccupied with the dude's leather jacket who was calling it, like trying to see like what the next thing the guy on the sideline would say, that I wasn't paying attention, or like trying to figure out the camera angle, which was like seemed to be at field level, but like rising and falling and like moving. It was interesting, but not in the ways that lacrosse games are interesting, in which the ball and the players are the star. It was more like every other intangible was like the refs, even, you know, yeah. The bias of the commentators kind of like overtook what was happening. And it's not the player's fault. It's not the coach's fault. It's not the team's fault. It's just this whole perfect storm of everything seemed off on the other side. So I was paying more attention to that than what was actually happening on the field. And that's probably a me problem, not a you problem, but it was really distracting. It was a unique experience. And it's probably because, you know, it took place like after the draft, and I was really in a bad place, man. I was in a bad place.
Damn, you were. This was a really nice, solid win, though, for Notre Dame. They keep kind of cruising along, got that nice win against Maryland under their belt. But where are we with Denver now? Because it's really hard to get a read on this team, because I feel like they're beating the teams that they should beat, but they every time they come against one of these top-tier opponents, they kind of let it seem to slip away. They're really in a gray area of, you know, we don't really know how good they are, how good they can be. There's obviously talent on the team. It's just like, what's going on here? And next week against Ohio State is going to be, I think, telling for both teams. Ohio State, the last unbeaten team in Division I lacrosse.
Yeah, I shouldn't share this hot take, but this is a hot episode anyway. I'm already in trouble. So I was talking to Patrick McEwen after this game, and I was like, hot take or not hot take? The best player to ever play in the Denver system offense is Wes Berg, and no one's approached that since, and that's the problem. How do we feel about that statement?
I feel like that's probably true because he was an amazing player.
But he was an amazing player because he did everything, and he moved great off ball. And there's not a ton of Dodgers on this team that like have the ability to survey and also dodge from different spots on the field. But you see French like behind the net most of the time. You know, he's filling the Cannizzaro role. But I think that teams have figured out that if you can hold that guy in check, you can pretty much hold a lot of the Denver offense in check as well. What do you think about that?
Now that's a take. I think that's probably an agreeable take. Interesting. All right, Kyle, let's move on to Sunday, a game I was in attendance for. Number one versus number two goes to number two, Cornell 18, Towson 11. Just watching this game in person, kind of felt very formulaic at the beginning. Towson got out to a hot start, like they usually do, won a bunch of faceoffs, guys were scoring, Kobe Smith being a beast in transition. That's the formula they've established in the early going as they've gone undefeated so far. And then Cornell just took it to them. Nine straight goals from the Big Red, and it was honestly such a stark shift in momentum. The lasting impression was the way Cornell got their possessions, because they only won six faceoffs in the entirety of the game and immediately started polling Alex Woodall at the faceoff X. So some of the turnovers can be attributed to a bit of sloppiness on the part of Towson, especially on the short turnaround. But I chalked a lot of it up to Cornell's ride because they were flying to the ball and hounding guys when Towson was trying to clear so many just like rushed passes that just went too far or went over players' heads. And then Chase Ehrlin, who got the start in this game, had 10 saves. And I would say, you know, 10 saves kind of seems average in the new shot clock area where, you know, guys are seeing a lot more shots overall. But it seemed like they were mostly clean saves that resulted in Cornell possessions. And then when you get the Cornell offense the ball, they're going to score. They did it against Penn State, too. I think the perception is that this Cornell offense is all Jeff Teat, but it's so much more than that. It's not even just Teat and Pedersen who have been playing together for, like, ever. The whole attack is phenomenal with Piatelli, who had a huge weekend. And then they have quite a few middies, especially Connor Fletcher, who can initiate offense and get defenses moving. I think the Big Red fans should be really encouraged by this victory because this Towson team is built to beat teams and built to beat teams, especially like Cornell, who entered the game winning at faceoffs at like 36%. You know, Milliman was very blunt in saying that, you know, they really needed to find other ways to get possessions and that this was the most they've had the ball in a while. So this offense is just so efficient.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm going to coincidentally pump Patrick McEwen again, who
talk a lot.
I feel like the quality of our conversations is really good. And that's what I'm focusing on. But we've been talking about Connor Fletcher dating back to last year. You know, the thing that you might not notice about him is that he's not only tall, but he's solid. So if he gets a size advantage, he can bounce a defender off him. Not like Tahoka can, but like in a way that uses their kind of defensive push to propel his momentum. You know, he makes you slide upfield because he's downhill, but his head is still up. Now, he's not looking across the cage. He's just looking to see what the defense is going to do. And then he moves it kind of 2X or over to the other side and pulls back and re-dodges. You know, half of Cornell's motions, especially if, like in their offense, especially if Teat is shut off, start with Fletcher getting the ball high and hammering on his guy to see what the defense does. He's just so pivotal into what they do. And also, you know, Cornell is using Piatelli much more effectively as a catch-and-go guy than they've done in the past, it's making a huge difference for him and them. You know, I think last year they used him as like an ISO dodger and a secondary ball carrier, like a little too much. And this role of being what I call like a hinge guy, which is a guy that kind of catches, moves it on, makes a quick decision or catches and goes, suits him much better. You know, catching and deciding to dodge or move the ball right away is his strength. You know, I think it also helps when you have guys like Clark Peterson to pass the ball to the back pipe. I mean, we were talking in the Slack earlier and I was like, oh yeah, Pettersson walked to eight goals. He just walked there.
Yeah, agreed.
You know what I mean? Like that's,
he just and like showed up. He's like, yeah, oh,
no,
there he
no,
is.
Not a slight. Like that's a skill too, is being in the right place at the right time. It's the ultimate skill for, you know, an off ball attackman. And he's just very good at it.
Yeah, agree. Being there in person, you know, Fletcher is a big dude and he wants that contact from the defender because he knows they're just going to bounce off of him. And he's going to get that step because of that. You know, Towson actually put Goodrich on him in this game. And I thought Goodrich did a pretty good job of just keeping him at bay and not really letting him move the defense like Cornell intended him to. But the respect for his game was certainly there. They're like, oh, man, this guy, like, we can't let him just, like, have free range running downhill. And, Peterson has, like, a spider sense because he knows when a shot is going to rebound. And when Teat is primed to give him a dime assist, I swear those guys are communicating telepathically. It's really something to see. But fun event down in Charlotte. I really enjoyed all the lacrosse I saw there. I got plenty of video highlights coming down the pipeline, so stay tuned for them.
Dan, was there a crown, and was it a classic experience?
There was no crown. At least I don't think so. Scoreboard recap. Lots of other results, big results, lots of other neutral site games. One of them was like the Philly Bonanza this weekend. They had all the schools in Philly basically get together to play each other. And one of the more interesting results was Penn taking down Villanova 13-11, Penn's first victory. Shout out Penn for finally coming through with a big weekend. Went from 0-3, took a sneeze, and are now 2-3. Got two wins in a matter of moments. Like we said, this team had impressed in their losses. One goal loss to Penn State, one goal loss to Maryland in a game that they probably should have won. And I think, you know, going into the weekend, a lot of people thought they'd be ripe to knock off Villanova and then get the job done.
I mean, I didn't. I picked Villanova. But again, I'm terrible at picking games. So, touche.
Do we want to have like a side rant about picks? Well, we already do that.
No, we've done the side rant about picks. We're good. We're good. Keep chirping, man. I'm here for it.
Rutgers 9, Princeton 8. I thought this was a really solid win for Rutgers here, beating a Princeton team that had played well against Hopkins and Virginia. They dominated Navy, and Rutgers had to hold off a strong comeback attempt from the Tigers in this one.
So what do we make of Princeton? Because they had a great win last week against Navy. And while the scoreline here suggests a close game, it was not close until the fourth quarter. Rutgers was up 8-3 at one point. You know, I know I'm like full of hot takes this week, but hot take. Without Sowers, Princeton is the second worst team in the Ivy League.
Ooh. That's harsh, bro. So I don't know, because I went to that Navy game and I came away really impressed with this team. And I think this Princeton team is good. They're just not better than most of the teams they are playing. And better team's going to win. The interesting thing is that no team has really been able to stop Michael Sowers yet, though. He's still averaging 6 points a game. Maybe they slowed him down, but he's still getting his buckets. Like, he's just putting up elite numbers yet again.
He's getting assists, and that's because teams are not locking him off. I said this many times so far in the podcast, every time we talk about Princeton, I just think their defense is chaotic. It's not together, and that's why they're losing games.
And they're not going to be as good on faceoffs as most of the teams are going to play.
True.
Yeah. Next game, Maryland 14, Albany 9. A close one for a little bit, but Maryland ultimately flexes their muscles and gets the job done.
Yeah, I think people want us to talk about why Tahoka isn't playing for the entire game, but I feel like that's not the story of this one, is it?
No, like I said, like this kind of got close. I think this Albany team is actually playing some really inspired lacrosse without Tahoka on the field. We don't really know what's going on right now. But, you know, I think Albany is in a similar camp where I don't necessarily think that they're a bad team. They're just playing really good teams week in and week out. And, you know, for Maryland, Bernhardt had a big game again. They won the majority of the faceoffs. Probably actually didn't win by a margin you might expect. They won, I think, 17 faceoffs to Albany's 10. But the thing about Maryland is that they continue to get some of the other guys on offense involved. I still think there's, you know, a little bit of a lack of depth of scoring beyond their top six. But, you know, they're getting guys involved and they're working on it. So it's a positive. You know, Maryland, though, they're the steady Eddie, I feel like. They just grind out wins. It's like a fail-safe formula that they've almost perfected in the past, like, 3 or 4 years. The only knock against them is that overtime loss to Notre Dame in an indoor facility that the Irish have probably never lost in. I don't even know, but they just always win in that Loftus Center. Of course, like you said, the big story here was Tahoka, who was eligible after a very strange saga and just... That was just weird, man. He was eligible yet benched for undisclosed reasons. Coach Scott Maher refusing to tell the media, you know, what was going on. There's not a lot of clarity in that telenovela right now with inside that locker room, what's going on in there. But it's certainly attracting attention. So something to just look forward to. I'm actually kind of turned off by the amount of attention like the Tahoka thing is getting.
I think it's fading down, but yeah, it was weird because the story changes, right? And that's, you know, what happens.
Yeah, we'll see how this plays out. I feel like this game should be called like the Dom Star Jalars Tiffany Bowl. Virginia 14, Brown 13 in overtime.
Here comes a rant, Dan. Buckle up.
Ooh.
Brown scored not one, but two open net goals. And scored at least three goals, you could argue four, by hitting a wide-open attackman who was standing uncovered at the top of the crease. Teams are going to watch this tape and see tons of ways to get cheap G's on the Cavs. I feel like Brown could have had more cheap goals. I'm not saying all Brown's goals were cheap, but most of them were. And cheap isn't easy, not cheap as in they were bad goals. It's just an easy goal. It's a goal because someone makes a mistake. I call those cheap goals. Brown had this game in hand. And then something kind of shifted. They kind of doubt that, you know, they didn't put their foot on the neck. Like we say, they let UVA get to their spots. And then UVA has too many shooters. You can't let them get comfortable. And that was that. You know, this was a game of two home run hitters just like pitching to each other and swinging as hard as they could. You know, swinging for the fences. It was like watching it. There was like timeouts and you're like waiting for a play. And it's like, plays, we don't have plays. Run the thingy. Go on, run it. And then like we're like, wait, was that a play? No, it probably wasn't because someone was in the wrong spot. It's the same thing that I've been saying about Virginia the whole time. It's all home run. It's all power. It's all behind the backs. It's all flash. Like, yes, there's substance behind it. I'm not saying there isn't any. But watching them play, especially in this one, you're just kind of like, what is happening? You know what I mean? Like what? I mean, Goss was great in cage. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to disparage, you know, his effort in between the Brown sticks. But honestly, sometimes it takes them time to can shots. And I just don't think that you can afford that going forward. Like there needs to be your bread and butter. Like Penn State has a bread and butter play that they get a shot off of on every possession. They run it when they need a goal. Not like all the time, but early shot clock, they have something that will get their best player, best shooter, Mac O'Keefe, a shot. Does Virginia have that? Because if they don't, they should this week. This week.
Okay. I completely missed this game. I'm looking forward to watching the replay because it seemed like just an exciting finish. I'm going to take a little bit.
No, it wasn't. It was frustrating. Okay. It was frustrating. You'll see. Guarantee you. I was very frustrated watching this game.
I'm going to take a little bit of an opposing viewpoint on this one because I feel like you have to tip your hat to Virginia for finding ways to win these overtime games. These are games that I would say the Virginia of the past 2 years may have lost. You know, I think about that first year, Lars Tiffany, they had so many close games where, like, they were in overtime and they just didn't pull it out. But I think we're seeing those seniors, and especially the juniors, Michael Krause, the game winner in this one, get this team over the hump despite all the shortcomings that we see. So I feel like this will give them confidence, and when they do turn it around, they'll still have that confidence.
Dude, they will not have confidence tying a Brown team, having to come back and having to win an OT. That this is a game that, like, I guarantee you Virginia thought they were going to win by six, and it didn't happen. Fair. Like, there's just too much stuff going on. I'm sorry. Like, if they, I get so frustrated when I see teams with so much talent, and like, there just needs to be a couple tweaks and a couple different ways of doing things, and just a settling of the, like, wild, nervous energy that's out there every time I watch you. Like, it's exciting. Don't get me wrong. It's super exciting, but it's also very stressful as you're watching, you know, because you know what's going to happen, but you're like, is he going to stick the shot though? That's kind of the only thing that matters, is the end result is what you're watching for UVA. And sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't, but you're right. They're winning these OT games, and that's huge, really matters, kind of confidence. So.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's true.
Quick aside real quick. I'm a huge fan of Brown's uniforms from this game. What did you think? I like the brown and the red. I think that looks so sweet. It's a little throwbacky.
I mean, they don't have a helmet that looks like a bear head. Why don't you have that yet?
On the helmet, right?
Yeah, just like do the whole bear. Have the eyes up by the...
Like the Redwoods.
Do that.
Redwoods, PLL, baby. He's a big fan of the bear helmet. He hasn't said it, but he...
No, I did. Someone asked me, hey, what PLL team do you support? And I was like, Redwoods. And I was like, no, wait, no. I mean, I cover the league. I can't support a team. But no, that their stuff is sweet. Angry Wise Bear is a great mascot choice.
The Wise Bear.
You know.
Kyle, final game we've got. Utah 10, Bellarmine 9.
So this is where we go back to one of our first pods of the year, where I was pumping up Vermont in the way that I do for my local people and didn't say enough nice things about Utah, and people got on me for it. But I'm going to say them now. Shout to the Utes for getting to four wins by the first weekend in March. That is a truly remarkable accomplishment for a first-year program. And by the way, this was their third win in a row. I'm astonished. Great job.
Yeah, shout out Utah. I know we set the over-under for wins by both new programs, Utah and St. Bonaventure, in the preseason pod, I think. And I set the over-under 3 wins for each team. So it's nice to see Utah hit the over here. And, you know, Josh Stout is a legit player. Second in the country in total goals right now with 26. I think so much of the goal this year for Utah has not necessarily been results-based, but rather instilling the process of what it means to be a D1 program that's transitioning from an MCLA program. But it looks like the work is paying off earlier than one might expect. So shout out the Utes. Definitely a feel-good story early in this season so far. Weird watch of the week. What do you got, you weirdo?
Me and my weird movies. So I checked out I say great in the write-up here. It wasn't great, but it was really thought-provoking. A movie called American Animals. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Movie? Yeah, it's a misadventure heist movie about a bunch of college kids that conspire to steal valuable books from the Library of Transylvania University. Dan, pop quiz, where is Transylvania University?
Kentucky. Because I saw the movie.
Oh, you saw the movie? Gotcha. Damn. I thought I had you. All right. Shout to Clara Bissell, assistant women's coach at Transylvania University, going to be helping us out with some MLL coverage. But basically the movie kind of ramps up, and then you find out that very early on in the movie that the people that this happened to are participating in the movie, like the students that kind of planned the heist. And it changes the entire dynamic of how you watch it, how you react to it. And the ending is like really sobering. And the one comment that someone makes at the end, I won't spoil it, is, you know, these guys just wanted a shortcut. They didn't want to put in work to succeed and get money, even though all of them were capable of that in their own right. They just went for this quick buck and tried to steal some really valuable books and make money because they thought it'd be easy, and it wasn't. And I won't spoil anything else, but I think if you like caper movies, you definitely have to watch it. It's a lot of fun. So I'm a big fan of revenge, and I'm a big fan of heist movies. So this one, I was all in on it. What did you see this weekend?
Yeah, well, I just want to say I've seen this movie as well recently within the past month. It's really cool. You should definitely check it out. And the point you mentioned is that it's both a recreation and a documentary at the same time, which I think is really unique and something that I had never seen before, because it's like the movie kind of plays out like a regular kind of movie. And then all of a sudden, like, oh, I'm the real person that did this. And you're like, whoa.
Yeah,
that's cool. And then you kind of like realize that, like, you're witnessing the recreation from their perspective. And their
you mean recreation?
Yeah.
Is, you keep saying recreation.
Yeah. Weird. The recreation, you know, is based on their perspectives, and, you know, don't want to spoil anything either. Their perspective can change as well. Definitely a cool movie, yep. Very well shot, and occasionally hilarious. Would you agree?
Yeah, there was parts of it that were pretty funny.
Yeah.
I was mostly off put by a lot of it, but I think that's the point.
Yeah.
You know.
Yo, shout out the Denver Notre Dame YouTube chat. We were welcomed as legends in the chat. Also, I do appreciate some good trolling, and there were quite a few good troll moments in that thread.
No, don't feed the trolls, Dan. Don't give them the attention.
Troll, troll, troll,
because then
troll,
they'll
troll.
Just keep coming back thinking it's funny. It's tired. One troll was good. There was like 20.
But they were funny.
And I turned it off. And a couple of them were funny. One of them was funny. And I definitely fell for it a couple times, so I'm not going to lie.
All right. Kyle, dive rule debate. Is it a debate or is it a rant?
Dan, dude, it's your turn. I legit have emptied out the rage cauldron with these games and the MLL draft. Like, I just need a break to replenish my strength. I can give no more to this debate. I can give you no more of myself. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You go.
I have a bad feeling we're going to see an injury soon. I feel like one might be coming. Just a bad feeling. I don't wish it to happen. I just feel like something is going to happen. There were a couple of clips I saw from this weekend where the goalie just has this violent movement. And even in one of the games I watched, I think Towson versus Cornell, there was a play where the offensive player just ended up colliding with the goalie's legs as they're basically just like straight, locked straight. And it just looks so scary to think that these two things are going to collide and something bad could happen. But, you know, other than that, I think we just see the rule just continue to be made in split-second decisions. And it's just kind of just like, I think it's gone beyond frustration where it's now kind of like we're viewing it apathetically. It's just like, oh, yeah, dive call.
Do you think that coaches are telling players to only dive from GLE? Because that looks to be the adjustment that I see.
Perhaps. I find it so interesting that so many offenses just have straight up embraced it. Like, just go for it. What's the worst that can happen? Like,
yeah.
We'll find out. We'll find
There's
out.
There's a lot.
We'll find out.
Thanks. A lot of things are going to happen.
All right, Kyle, our final segment, the Tucker Dordovic play of the week. There's like no like home run hitter right here. I feel like this is a very, very varied week for plays of the week,
which is why I went with two choices As many of you may know, I am a sucker for long pole goals, and I have two of them to lay on you that I bet you didn't see. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Rutgers long pole, Garrett
Michaeli? I think.
Michaeli? Wow, not even close, Kyle. Scored a buzzer beater at the end of the first quarter against Princeton to make it 3-2. And it was one of those, no way he's going to score. But it might happen because he's a pole kind of goals. He was a little too far out. But as goalies have told me many, many times, it's hard to read a shot from a long pole, which to me sounds like an excuse, but I've never met a goalie without a lot of excuses. So that tracks. The second goal was of a similar nature, but comes from the D3 ranks, senior long pole for Capital Men's Lacrosse. Dan, where's Capital?
Don't know.
It's in Ohio. Capital captain, yup, Chris Yeager, grabs a GB, runs in a straight line that only a defenseman who does not cross the half line runs in, power cradles past everyone, and does the thing that people who shoot that are wide open but don't know what to do when they're wide open, put their entire body into the shot in a way that almost makes them fall down. He rips it, score, and apparently is his first goal ever in a game, if Capital's Twitter is to be believed, in his entire life. Dan, I have included the highlight in our rundown. How does it make you feel to know that information?
Damn, powerful. Yeah, I feel like he's just like running down the field and you can start to hear like the Titanic music ramp up. He's like, this is my moment. And he just, you're right though. Like you watch it. He just throws his whole body into it. It's just like an awkward motion because you know, he's not practiced this much.
Yeah. And there's no way he saw it go in because his head is like turned to the ground, but hey, no shots. Shout to Capital, who actually won this game 18-6 over Grove City. Now 4-1 this season. And if I may, make sure to listen to this week's Inside the Cross D2 D3 podcast that will include a Mustang Classic preview tomorrow on the Isle podcast feed. Dan, that's what we call cross promotion.
Kyle Devitt, I would wager the wagon of Inside Lacrosse podcasters. He's a wagon. I think Division One, though, goal-wise, I think Joey Epstein's one-headed goal for Hopkins was pretty sweet. I think that was the goal you were referring to when you were talking about absurd goals happening in the Carrier Dome.
Yes. Yes. One of them, yes.
Real ones, though, if you've followed Joey Epstein's career, you know that this is, like, maybe his 100th one-handed wraparound goal. I don't know. It's kind of like a known trademarked move by him, but it was pretty cool to see it. I did have two behind the back assists from Grant Ament that I saw in real life that were pretty sweet though.
And you had that Jeff Yeat top corner.
Jeff Yeat. Yeah, he's pretty good. But you know what I've noticed about his shooting stroke is that he kind of shoots it very box like, where it's not predicated on power. It's predicated on snappy releases, deception, getting a screen, but he's still nailing top corner. It's really cool.
Yeah.
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 It's something else. Guys, that is our show. Everyone out there, if you like what you hear, please give us a rating and please tell a friend. Word of mouth is great stuff. We appreciate all the listens. You can find me at Dan_Abern on Twitter. You can find Kyle at TheKyleDevitt on Twitter. Signing off for next week. We'll see you guys then. Appreciate the listen.
Yeah. Yeah.